A German mother was educated in Italy, came to the University of Virginia, graduated summa cum laude at the University of Virginia in history, received his master's degree in public administration and his PhD in international affairs and foreign affairs from UVA. He spent a year at the Miller Center learning to be an administrator. He administered the summer intern program, which we instituted at the Miller Center. He was then appointed a professor at Monterey Institute of International Affairs and spent 3 years there in the process forming a Russian Studies Center, which has had a wide-ranging and impressive list of publications. He then went to Philadelphia and became Thornton Hooper Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Center, which was an integral part of the University of Pennsylvania for many years, now is an autonomous institute. He's a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow assigned to the State Department, and he's asked that I make note of the fact that he's speaking entirely as a private scholar, not as a representative of the State Department. He'll speak to us today on policy making in a rapidly changing world. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. He will speak in English, however he knows. However, he knows five separate languages, and if he lapses, well, you'll know the reason.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. I often sat around the table here looking at other distinguished speakers, wondering, you know, sort of in my fondest hopes that someday I might myself occupy such a position. Policymaking in a rapidly changing environment, well, that's sort of the task that people in government are faced with these days. I came aboard the Department of State in a peculiar capacity, and I suppose to give you some perspective on what it is I do and my background, I ought to say a few words about that. The Council on Foreign Relations is a private organization that encourages a very interesting and fruitful exchange. That is to say, they take about a dozen academics and place them in government service, and at the same time they take about a dozen people in government service and place them in academic institutions to cross-fertilize each of them. When I applied, I thought of going to the usual institution that people in this program go to, and that's the Office of Policy Planning, which does longer-term think pieces. As it happens, they already had someone in that capacity that would be overlapping with my time. But it turned out that an office that is sort of the motor of U.S.-Soviet relations, the Office of Soviet Union Affairs, was looking for someone in a slightly different capacity than it's ever had, and that is to have their own policy planner. Indeed, it seems to be a popular innovation these days. A lot of agencies, a lot of areas in government are starting to think about the longer-term implications of what is happening in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and how to deal with those. Recently, my boss, the director of the office, described what I do and in a memo that he wrote, in which he said, I write policy memos for the seventh floor. But I must admit, from the fourth floor where I sit to the seventh floor is a much further distance than just three floors. There it takes a long time for things to travel up. I have a different definition of what I do. And when people ask me, I say, I think heretical thoughts. And then I try to put them on paper, and we see where they go to within the building, where they finally come to rest. And it's in this connection that I'd like to propose a few thoughts here today. Specifically with regard to a question that I often see in the press, a sort of statement or conclusion that the United States, and the president in particular, is lagging behind events in Eastern Europe, that the administration lacks a vision, is too cautious, and even after the Malta meeting and subsequent high-level meetings, such as the ministerial meeting that we'll be having in February with the Soviets, there's a lingering sense that someone ought to be doing more. I'd like to propose two ideas and then have your thoughts and comments. I'll argue that the United States government, the administration, is doing a good job given its task and the limitations of democratic government. Much of the criticism that is addressed to the president and the government on this behalf is misplaced because it does not appreciate, I believe, the proper role of government. In addition, it has the additional disadvantage of shifting our attention away from the real problem in this area. That is to say, the real reason we don't have a lot of creative solutions at this time, which I believe is the inability of our traditional sources of intellectual inspiration, academics, think tanks, journals, newspaper columnists, to provide us thus far with a far-sighted vision of a future Russia's role in world affairs. I think the latter, much more than the former, should be a cause for concern. Let me, however, say a few words first about the United States government's role and then shift to the second point. The plea to do something is in no small degree, I believe, a plea for vindication between those factions in our intellectual community that debated for generations about how to conduct the Cold War. There's a strange coincidence between those neo-isolationists who see Soviet changes as an excuse to cash in on the peace dividend, whose monies have already been spent 10 times over, and the activists who see it as an affirmation of American virtue and idealism. Neither of these, I believe, is really correct. In reality, what is unfolding in the Soviet Union is a domestic drama, an internal argument that has remained unresolved since the 19th century. America has contributed very little to resolving this argument among the domestic parties. This is for two reasons. Partly because of Russia's self-absorption in these events, with events like the October Revolution, the Civil War, the tragedy of forced collectivization and industrialization, then global competition with the West. And partly, I'm afraid, the result of the fact that our own policies have not, over the past generation, endeared us to those who fought for democratic change in those countries. By that I mean that we have consistently supported the status quo in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe until today, and the changeover to something different is still not very clear in our minds what it is that we really want there, other than, of course, we want democracy, we want good things for all people. Secondly, Gorbachev has so dominated the world stage precisely because of the magnitude of his problems, contrasted to which our own problems seem minor. He faces economic collapse, ethnic civil war, possibly massive labor unrest. The fact that the spotlight is on him in world affairs and consequently has shifted away from us in the global arena is, again, a reflection of the fact that what is happening over there is high drama, and our own secondary status in the global media is at least partly a reflection of our own tranquility, prosperity, and just boring success. Turning to administrative considerations, our ability to react creatively is constrained by the functions assigned to governments in a pluralistic democracy. As with most bureaucracies, the government runs by compromises, which generally bring creative initiatives down to their lowest common denominator. I think anyone who's sat in on a committee knows what this means. I can say, just from my small perspective in one particular office, that there are a number of initiatives generated. There's nothing that I've read about in the press or in any journal that somebody hasn't thought of already in the State Department, and even gone beyond simply thinking of and tried to give some substance to say, well, if we're going to do this, this is going to happen, this is how much it's going to cost, et cetera, et cetera. This is what needs to be coordinated to do this. However, in the massive paperwork that is engendered and created in doing this, a very small part of it then gets to the assistant secretary level, an even smaller part gets to the secretary, who then has to coordinate with his peers, and finally the president makes some decision, very largely based not perhaps on the abstract merits of the case as regards specifically foreign policy, but on some domestic priority. This isn't the right time to push this initiative because it wouldn't fly right, or it wouldn't sit right with this group or that group. All of these things tend to limit the truly sort of inspirational moves and consensus by the very fact of having to build a consensus. I'm not arguing by any means that nothing could be done better. Arguably, certain initiatives that we finally did take after Malta or at Malta could have been agreed upon earlier. Indeed, the French did seem to reach a greater consensus earlier. The Germans were very much out in front in trying to forge a European consensus on what conditions in the Soviet Union were like, what sorts of things were happening there, and how we ought to respond as an alliance. Certain types of decision making could be streamlined. But a lot of the way we do things in the United States is part of the price we pay for having the input of so many people at so many different levels of government. In fact, I think most of my European counterparts are stunned by the fact that we discuss things with so many different people, so every which way from Sunday, and then we wait and see whether some consensus hasn't come out of this. Soviet policy in West Germany is made, I think, by 10 times fewer people than it is in this country, and not simply because of the numerical size of the country or anything like that. It's just that there isn't this imperative to try to get everybody on board. I can't write a letter that isn't read in three different offices and commented upon, and if there's any disagreement, then we have to debate about that, and one of the principals will have to decide which wording is correct if we don't agree with this. And it's not just because I am a novice or someone like that. I actually have been given a fair degree of responsibility and become sort of part of the team. It's simply the way things are done in the State Department and in many other, I think most other bureaucracies. The fact that on any serious initiatives, probably half a dozen agencies will have to be involved, with every level of management involved within that agency, means that all the concerns must be voiced, all the concerns must at some point be reconciled, and that slows the process down. But you might ask, doesn't the rapidly changing world environment demand greater flexibility, greater creativity right now? Well, perhaps, but again, I think that UN's foreign policy, as conducted by the State Department, has primarily been to safeguard against possible dangers, rather than to innovate, rather than to change the world in some way. It's to protect basic, fundamental American concerns and values. Inevitably, at the same time, you safeguard against some worthwhile ideas. We are, as an institution of government, only marginally concerned with opportunities lost in the pursuit of safety and stability. And this obviously is not a formula for creative approaches. You have to take risks if you want creativity. But then I would tend to argue that creativity is not the best measure by which to gauge the success of a nation's conduct in foreign policy. Any diplomat will tell you that diplomacy needs continuity, it needs stability, it needs negotiating over and over the points so that there is a dialogue and so that the words that you're using mean the same things from one meeting to the next meeting. Navigating the present uncertain waters in such a way as to enhance American interests is challenge enough for U.S. foreign policies in uncharted waters. But I also believe very strongly that in addition to watching out for reefs and shoals upon which to run aground, we also desperately need a global map, a vision of the world as we would like to see it a generation from now. This, however, is a problem, an issue that is really divorced from everyday policymaking. It's not an appropriate question for government because government is not equipped to handle it. Most Foreign Service officers feel they have a very full plate in handling day-to-day affairs, and the rest is far too speculative, far too intangible. This task of creating a vision of the world as we would like to see it is therefore devolves to academics, newspaper columnists, and people in think tanks who I believe tend to lag behind events by 6 months or more and at present show little sign of catching up. The key question, I believe, that we should be addressing is how to deal with a Russian Federation in the next century, and I use that Russian word advisedly to distinguish it from Soviet, with the disruptions in Central Asia and perhaps Europe that may arise as a result of the diminution of the Soviet Union to some Russian confederation. This, I believe, is the direction we are headed. How are we preparing for it? Presently, the United States is ill-prepared to deal with the appearance of political pluralism and diversity of states in Russia today. The situation in our political analysis of the Soviet Union today, I believe, mirrors that of our economic analysis in the mid-1980s. That is to say, no one had considered in the beginning of the 1980s the possibility of a transition of centrally planned economies to market mechanisms. It was an interesting philosophical exercise that people who didn't have anything better to do might engage in, but it wasn't a real possibility, and therefore there weren't any funds available for it. There just wasn't any interest in that sort of thing. As a result, the fact that seething social discontent could inspire massive political revolt against social systems in Eastern Europe was not even considered by the vast majority of the intellectual community. And this fact has serious consequences today. There is still a chance that because we so completely missed the underlying currents of Eastern European societies for generations, the single greatest opportunity for advancing freedom in the latter half of the 20th century may be wasted. Now, of course, the primary impetus for change and responsibility for successful transition lies in those countries. And there is a strong argument that those academics should have been the ones primarily concerned with this. However, as fate would have it, they expected us to have a lot of answers to their questions. And we find ourselves in the awkward position of not having that much to say except, well, don't you understand how markets work? Here's a market. Why don't you go and create one? Well, there's a big problem. This problem is called transition. And they don't know how to get to our side from where they are, and we don't know how to get to their side from where, or how to bring them over. And so we're both looking at this big, uncharted, unknown territory and wondering what to do about it 5 to 10 years too late. If we'd had a 5 to 10 year lead time in which some small group had been thinking about these problems of transition, arguably we would have been that much further ahead today. Today, I believe we're likewise missing the currents underlining the changes in Soviet Russia. We have almost no conceptual framework for it and little in our academic training that can assist us, with a few noted exceptions. I'd say Fred Starr's work, he's president of Oberlin College, James Billington's articles started yesterday and over the next 2 days in the Washington Post, I think are extremely interesting and very valuable, and a handful of emigre academics. It is not government, I would argue, but the private intellectual arena which has traditionally nourished our foreign policy community that has failed to provide us with intellectual guidance. Nearly all the serious analysis by Soviet specialists in their books, in their articles, has focused on trying to explain to themselves and their colleagues how remarkable indeed the changes are. Senior scholars seem at times more interested in scoring their colleagues than in explaining why these changes, which shocked so many Western observers, at the same time, and this point is not often brought up, appeared inevitable and completely understandable to many in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. In other words, these weren't people who were working for a hopeless cause. They believed that they would succeed. They were surprised at the time frame in which they succeeded. They were surprised at how quickly they were thrust into power. But they had an ultimate faith that this was the trend of the future and acted accordingly and tried to establish civic institutions in their own countries accordingly. A typical example, I think, is a recent letter in the Washington Post of the tenor of the academic debate in this country between two very senior, respected scholars, much of whom in their own right have very much to contribute in to understanding aspects of Soviet Union. This is Jerry Huff responding to an article by Peter Redaway. "Never have I seen such total nonsense. In the past, only left-wingers and fellow travelers thought the Soviet dictator a democrat, but today even conservatives, such as Professor Redaway, confuse Mikhail Gorbachev with Lech Walesa." And he goes on to say, "What is the State Department doing about all this? Have they forgotten that we're talking about 1989, not 1929? Surely it has to be 1989, for in 1929 no high State Department official would be so foolish as to write, or the Post to publish, an article on the end of history. It's governmental anarchy in the United States, the unwillingness to make decisions, complacency, and this situation should concern us." Again, I think Professor Huff has missed the boat as to where the responsibility for thinking about the future of the country in a longer term perspective really ought to lie. Our scholarship on the Soviet Union contrasts poorly with much of the Soviet literature today in leading Soviet journals, in other words, what they are writing themselves. That literature is grappling anew with the central issues of Russian history, political culture, religious and philosophical traditions in illuminating and provocative ways. The main reason that our Soviet analysts have not fulfilled their responsibility for providing a coherent vision of what factors will motivate Soviet society in the next century is because, in my opinion, they are mesmerized by the actions of a small coterie of political leaders at the very top. Overwhelmingly, our analysis of Soviet affairs devolves to Gorbachev. What does Gorbachev want? What does Gorbachev think? How does he get up in the morning? Who does he say to this or that? I call this Copernican Sovietology. You know, it's a very focused on the sun, and the sun is Gorbachev. When he rises, the day begins. When he falls, the day ends. The ridiculousness of this could not be more manifest than in his recent trip to the Baltic states and how it was covered in much of the press, particularly the television, which of course reaches a much vaster audience in the United States. In the media, Gorbachev's quandaries, real difficulties in that situation, his possible intentions, even his remarks to his wife, I recall on NBC News, were given greater attention than the really intrinsic difficult situations that the Baltic leaders themselves faced, their analysis of it, their solutions of it, the complexity with which they were, on the one hand, trying to reach an accord with Gorbachev, on another hand, moving back. All of this, we were losing sight of the fact that there were at least two areas here, and really many more that needed to be looked at by focusing on whether Gorbachev would succeed or not, what was his political destiny in all this, seemed to be the preeminent concern. The distortion inherent in this top-heavy approach to Soviet society is becoming increasingly apparent with regard to events in Russia proper. I would argue that what we need instead of a Copernican approach is a Newtonian approach to Soviet scholarship. That is to say, one in which the interaction of a variety of different mechanisms that extend really outside the traditional boundaries of the way in which we have studied the Soviet Union for many years. That is to say, moving away from just political science to include a study of culture, of religion, of literature. All of this is tremendously important today because the very components of the political debate are inspired by the Russian literature of the 1950s and 1960s, the so-called village prose writers. Today is their political heyday, and anyone who has not read that literature in English translation or in Russian or whatever, it's even available, and many of the writings are available in English translation, cannot understand the aspirations of the Russian people today and why it is that they are, on the one hand, supporting many of Gorbachev's initiatives and arguing for more radical changes in areas like decollectivization, in areas like regional decentralization for the Russian Republic. On the other hand, they are very fearful of anarchy. They are very fearful of bloodshed. They go out and stop, mothers go out and stop their sons from going to Azerbaijan, say, to heck with it, it's a foreign country, let them be, we don't need it. And so that the marshal, the chief of the general staff, has to rescind an order for calling up reserves. I mean, imagine the circumstances of popular discontent in that country. To be more specific, we have largely missed the significance of the Soviet parliament. And that, by the way, is how it is frequently referred to in the Soviet press, not the Congress of People's Deputies, but increasingly simply parliament, with all the implications that that word brought into our language from the French implies. That parliament, which has rejected 9 key legislative initiatives advanced by the government, that parliament that has rejected Politburo members for cabinet positions last year, that parliament which elected a non-communist minister for the cabinet, that in the first free elections held in the Soviet bloc in March of last year, overwhelmingly voted against the Communist Party leadership in the Russian areas alone, not to mention the Baltic states and others, 70 Communist Party candidates lost in 76% of the territorial districts in which they ran. And the reason that there are so many communists in that body today is only because of the manipulation of the content of that body by guaranteeing one-third of the that one-third of its delegates would be either members of the party or of party-sponsored institutions. That, by the way, is another one of those initial pieces of legislation which has been discarded toward the end of the last parliament and will not be present in the next elections. Our analysts seem unfortunately too unimpressed by the fact that over 1 million citizens are now active in over 60,000 informal political associations with a widespread network across Russia proper. For nearly a year now, these groups have been coordinating their political platforms in preparation for the upcoming local elections of March 1990. Despite all that we see, looking just underneath the surface, looking a little bit beyond Gorbachev, the common assumption, however, that Gorbachev's fate determines the fate of Perestroika, I think still predominates, and that is false. I strongly suspect that in the 1990s, we will eventually have to acknowledge that in the Soviet Union, as in this country, all politics is local politics. Academics and other observers generally have the freedom to pursue their vision. But in too many instances, a narrow training and expertise hamper them from a really sort of expansive long-range view. By contrast, people in government have a great thirst for such vision. They really, you know, the proliferation of policy planning agencies at every sort of interstices of government is a reflection of the fact that they don't see things coming from academics that is really useful to them. I don't know how many times I've gotten stuff that is sent to our office and is sent directly to the director, and he sends it back to me and says, more academic gobbledygook, and I have to sort of summarize if there's anything of value, and it's surprisingly little that I can use, that we can use to say, gee, you know, that's a good idea. That's a good vision, you know, somewhere we could head for the country that would offer a plateau, some sort of stability on the international arena 10 years from now, 15 years from now, given the trends that we see in world affairs. There's very little of that. Much of what we see is very narrowly focused on this particular problem he faces, that particular problem he faces. Oh, isn't it terrible? Of course it's terrible. But nonetheless, life will go on. We'll have to do something about that. What we need, I believe, is a reexamination of long-standing assumptions vis-a-vis Russian and Eastern European cultures. I find it very revealing, for example, and I heard this remark again at a very prominent gathering of our Sovietological elite, that Sovietologists will often remark, half facetiously, that while all the sinologists love China, all the Sovietologists hate Russia. I dare say that this attitude will have to change before we can really begin to appreciate the magnitude of what is happening in world history. The slow but inexorable return of Russia to the European family of nations is, I believe, what we are actually witnessing. We will have to understand the full historical, cultural, religious, and philosophical dimensions of this restoration before we can even begin to appreciate what this will mean for the United States. And it has serious implications for the United States. I think there's often a too facile assumption that our cultural values have leapt over the continent, over the great divide of the oceans, and embedded themselves firmly into foreign soil. I don't see that as being the case. I think our cultural influence on the rest of the world is largely superficial, and there could be very quickly a backlash to it, the kind of backlash that we've seen, unfortunately, in some large area countries in the Third World. Not to say that they would turn anti-American, but that is to say that there are strong components of American values that are not entirely consonant with the rediscovery of national identity and historical identity in many of the nations of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union that we see today. And I think it's incumbent upon us to understand them much more than they to understand us. Well, that's basically my remarks. Thank you.
We've asked two of our younger scholars, again following General Elliott. I was in the Army and I know you take commands. To make comments, to ask the first questions if they wish. I don't know if Stephanie Perry Leach is here. Charles Krupnik, who was a nuclear submarine commander before he took on the much more difficult task of being a graduate student at UVA.
Yeah, in that light, since we're in the nuclear, it strikes me that one of the compelling reasons for our conservatism in policy is because they are a nuclear power, and specifically in the area of nationalities, and I'm not familiar with the distribution of their weapons in the Soviet Union, but how much of a concern is it that some of the Soviet nuclear assets could fall into the hands of some radical or civil war type situation where world security would actually be an issue? And is that discussed?
Well, oh yes. It is discussed. I've seen the idea floated about in the press. There's very little we can do about it, one way or the other. We are not going to be able to hold the empire together, just as we really could not really effectively encourage its disintegration. It acts on its own impetus. That problem is really, in my mind, not a qualitatively different problem from the problem of terrorism generally. In other words, if there is going to be a transition to authority, to another authority, stable transition to another stable authority anywhere in the Soviet Union, either for the country as a whole or parts of it, then that problem should not arise, because responsible leaders would tend to act responsibly. If irresponsible leaders get a hold of such weapons, well, then it's the same sort of problem that we've envisioned in our own minds as to what might happen in the United States if a nuclear weapon gets in the hands of terrorists. It's a contingency we shall have to deal with. There's really not much to speculate about in terms of. There's nothing we could really do in that case. I suppose the central government of the Soviet Union would be very much concerned and would take all steps necessary to prevent that sort of occurrence.
Stephanie, do you want to come to the door and ask your question?
How is Ellen Karyadonkos' book that was published a few years ago, The Decline of an Empire, in which she mentioned that the Soviet Union was on the verge of self-destruction because of the nationalities problem. How was that received by the State Department? All the academics that I know poo-pooed the idea. I thought the book was incredibly sensationalistic, and this seems very innovative to me in retrospect. I too thought the book was rather sensationalistic when I read it, but in retrospect, she seems to be more in the ballpark than any of the other academics that I knew before. How was that received?
It's hard to speak for thousands of Foreign Service officers. I don't really know. I know that people tend to be well informed about day-to-day events there and have their own opinions about long-term prospects. The thesis of the book, which is not unique to her, but has been floated around before her and since her, that the Soviet Empire is subject to collapse has been one that's been in the air, just hasn't sort of materialized. Again, what we're seeing is surprising to us, mainly in the degree of the rapidity with which events occur. That's one point. Another point I'd like to make is they have a saying in Russian about not whistling at people's graves, you know, before they're actually buried. Yes, things are happening in the margins. Although I don't want to argue that Lithuanians are marginal anyway. At the outer rim of the empire, we're seeing tensions, we're seeing separatist aspirations. However, the inspirations, the sources of those tensions in the Baltic states are very different than they are in Azerbaijan. The way Armenians view their ties with the Soviet Union is very different from the way the Georgians view their ties with the Soviet Union. Until quite recently, that is to say, Armenians, in reaction to the sense that they had been abandoned by Moscow and they were arming themselves, until that point, polls indicate that only 2% of Armenians wanted to leave the Soviet Union. By contrast, Azeris have a much larger majority, Georgians appear to as well, and the Baltic states. There's a debate, really, all over the world among foreign service establishments as to whether this, the separation of certain regions has already been accepted as something that the Soviet government now has to work toward, it's accepted and is working toward, or whether they're going to fight it tooth and nail and the consequences that will arise from that. I think it'll have to be a case-to-case basis. I think the Ukraine will be, and Belarusia will be the largest problems in that area. Although I must say that I think aspirations for separatism there are also among the weakest right now, for a variety of peculiar historical, religious, and cultural reasons. So, you know, there's an awareness of that, and I think what I would hope for is a sense of policy around some sort of scenarios, built around scenarios that are described in a longer-term perspective. I mean, people in the State Department don't get to read more than 2 pages, really, you know. I mean, any memo written for the secretary has to be 2 pages or less, so that's it. And you only get to put forth one idea there, or react to one idea. To the extent that they can have time to read books, I'd like to see more of those books deal with sort of what U.S. policy might be in a very different world environment than we're seeing now, one that might, as a point of speculative departure, start with a Russian Federation that has essentially abandoned certain areas to their own sort of ways and accepted that and wants to live in that context. That's a radical thought still today. I think most people are still working on the old assumption that Gorbachev is the best Russian we can find, and it's uncertain what the rest of the people want, and they would want to hold together the empire at all costs. I think that's less and less true.
Other questions? General Elliott?
If harassment does it, I'll keep harassing this outstanding. It seems that somewhere in my background that this was predicted, it came out of the long telegram of a chap named Mr. X. It was not only predicted, the fact is that it took us so long, instead of 10 years, which everybody dreamed, it nevertheless came to pass. Now, when you look back what the containment policy was about, it was eventually to happen that the social unrest, going to your point, the differences in the ethnic and the linguistic and all of that, as well as the economic, would eventually reach into the very heart of the Soviet Union and it would implode. It's happening. Now, I'm interested that you're overwhelmed, well, I am overwhelmed by the rapidity, and also that the catalyst happened to be the Russian chief of state. But the fact of the matter is that this was, the containment policy was clear and unequivocal throughout its whole concept.
I agree, and this is, to a certain extent, a vindication of containment. Although I think the specifics of what Mr. Kennan thought about containment and its implementation has been the subject of numerous books, even now. Having said that, it's time to move on. It's time to move on to the question of what values will replace those that we thought dominated the political system of the Russian heartland. And that is a really, really difficult question, and a tremendously important question, because without an understanding of the values, the fundamental aspirations of the people who will be coming to power in the next generation, in an entirely different political environment. And by this I want to stress that even, like, there are many worst-case scenarios, and many people do predict the fall of Gorbachev. Well, eventually he will fall. I mean, no one lives forever. So whether it's 10 years, 20 years, eventually he will be gotten rid of. The question, I suppose, revolves around whether the institutions that he has established form a sufficient basis for a different evolution of the Soviet political system. And I know that there are tremendous debates, very erudite people argue many different aspects of this. I would, however, make one point, not with regard to whether the institutions themselves are solidly entrenched or irreversible. I would argue this. The Communist Youth League is the breeding ground for the future leaders of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In 4 years, the Communist Youth League has lost 10 million members. This year, 1989 alone, it has lost 4 million members. At this rate of growth, the Communist Youth League will have no members by 1990. In Lithuania, the Communist Youth League has disbanded itself. Similar moves are underway in the Baltic states. In the Russian Republic itself, there is a move to disband the All-Union Communist Youth League and simply have a Russian Federation of Youth, very much like they have in Hungary today. This is the future leadership of the Soviet Union. That's all I would submit. We're not talking about what the people in power today only are thinking about for the next 5 years. We have to be thinking about as well what the people who are in their 20s and 30s, who are occupying or will someday occupy positions of power, will be doing with the inheritance left to them, which may be abysmal, it may be dismal, but what will they be, what sorts of values and ideas and inspirations will they rely upon? It's not too early to think about that.
Professor Birnbaum.
First, I'd like to comment on your disappointment with the academic input into this picture. I think your expectations were entirely too high. Anyone who knows, for example, about what's happened academically in economics knows that for half a century, commerce schools, business schools, have generally not consulted their economics departments, even though they might be 100 yards away. Because the economists have more and more looked into their computers and developed models which businessmen seem very little use for. Most of the time. Political scientists aren't too much better, and they're getting more computerized too, and going into model building. And it's very hard to crank into models the literature that you're speaking of that we ought to look at to give it a numerical evaluation so you can get your correlations in proper perspective and so forth. Fortunately, there are a few exceptions, but there are a few. Knowledge of a very important third world country. And I'm not at all surprised that much of its culture affects both its politics and its economics, but what is most surprising is the degree to which its politics and economics reflects global trends, global ideas. We are becoming, it seems to me, much more of a society which interchanges culture, and therefore there's a danger if we only crank in the historic local, though certainly you must know it.
Well, if my expectations are high, I plead guilty. I went to the University of Virginia. With regard to global ideas versus national ideas, well, of course, each individual, we're talking about a group, a generation, there will be tremendous number of intellectual influences, and these people as a group, I suspect, it's hard to quantify these things, will be more open to ideas from their Western counterparts, among others. However, one of the strong motivating forces in the current reform movement is not merely an opening to the West, it is also a rediscovery of one's own roots, if you will. And I strongly suspect that this will be a dominant political force. If I were to project for the interim period, I suspect that rediscovery will be more important and will find a greater political resonance. Again, thinking more in the terms of what sorts of political parties are going to arise, what's going to motivate them, which are going to be popular, who their leaders are going to be. That's the sort of thing that I'm looking at in the next several years. We already see it. By the end of the year, we're going to have a multi-party parliament in Estonia and Lithuania, probably in Latvia. And all indications are that in Estonia we will have about 10 or 12 different parties ranging across the entire political spectrum. They will tend to have the same sort of political spread as parties do everywhere. But one of the things that the country as a whole is reacting against, and that has been a leading force in inspiring the popularity of the popular fronts, where they have been most prominent, most successful, has been something we've called in the West nationalism. But really, I think, is national revival, not specifically simply as an ism or as a negative connotation, but a reflection on the values lost in the attempt to pursue an international Soviet model, an international conglomerate of nations. And that's why I focused my own research interest on that particular component. I may be wrong. I mean, there's no doubt that these people are seeking inspirations from every possible source. They are also seeking inspiration from their own past historical traditions that they are just now rediscovering.
Ken, may I have a follow-up?
Yeah, but let's pass it around to Al to be
just,
sure.
Just briefly.
Very briefly.
Yeah. That finding one's local roots and history is global.
Secretary,
Nick, I'm interested in, you're no longer an academic, you're now in the seats of power, so to speak. So let's talk about some really basic policy questions, which your background is pretty rich. We are going to face a policy dilemma fairly quickly, it looks to me like, if things don't take a different path. In terms of the Baltic countries, Lithuania and the lead, having made it quite clear that we're clearly for the restitution of national power to Eastern European countries. We're going to be very much on the spot to, and particularly since we have a background of never having recognized the incorporation of the Baltic, three Baltic states. And we're going to be under increasing pressure if, unless the Lithuanians decide they're going to abate their pressure to deal with the problem of the Lithuanian demands for independence. Without asking you to say where we're going to come out in policy, what I'm curious to know is what is the department's vision of, back up just a second, I think I understood you to imply rather heavily that our policy presumptions are proceeding on the view that the Soviet empire is going to collapse. I didn't mean to misquote you, but I thought I sensed that in the very earliest part of your thing. So do we assume in our policy that independence for the Baltic states is just the first of the rest of the 15 dominoes, and you're going to have 15 national states instead of the Soviet empire, or that the Soviets are going to try to stitch together some kind of, I believe you used the word federal, a federal Russian state. I wasn't quite sure what that meant, because the Russians are the biggest power, but federal means they've still got hold of some of the rest of them. What's the vision of the nationalities problem on which our policy is predicated?
I knew somebody would ask a question like this. The Baltic states. Well, first of all, let me back up and say that I'm speaking as an academic, and the thoughts that I'm ruminating about are my own. I don't wish to imply that there's any consensus of opinion in the department about whether the Soviet Union is going to hold together or collapse or how it's going to do any of this. That having been said, one can address the specific issue of the Baltic states, because Secretary Armitage pointed out the United States policy is officially one of not recognizing the annexation, or seeing that annexation as a forced annexation and not recognizing it as legitimate for the three Baltic republics. We therefore implicitly view those states in a different category than the rest of the Soviet Union. And it may not have escaped your notice that we reacted with a very different wording to the military intervention, the Soviet military intervention in Azerbaijan, than we do in official press statements issued prior to this with regard to the possible contingencies that might arise in the Baltic states if Gorbachev were to fail in his efforts there. The Baltic republics, they're, without wanting to say that there's any consensus of opinion on, without speaking for the Department of State, okay, I would say that it's pretty obvious, just reading the press, that events are moving very quickly in the Baltic states. It would be obvious that that the United States government is looking at the contingencies that will arise in the interim between today and the point in time at which it is possible that one or more of those republics declare independence and establish themselves as sovereign nations again. Okay. That's where most of our attention is focused right now. What will happen? When is it likely to happen? What is the possible Soviet response? And what is our possible response to the Soviet response? Does that answer your question?
Let me suggest we've heard from the those people who have been tarnished by the deficiencies of the academic community. Let's have just a few questions from those of you at large. Yes, George Palmer.
Would you address the same question in regard to Cuba, third world countries, like it's backing now, and what happens now?
Well, I think that we expect the Soviet sort of withdrawal of interest. It's maybe too strongly worded. We are noticing that the Soviets are turning inward with respect particularly to their foreign commitments. This is going at different levels in different countries. However, in addition to the obvious gestures that one might have, such as withdrawal of troops or reduction of foreign aid or stopping of arms shipments that were scheduled, things like that, one of the things that I think is most indicative of the orientation over the future of the Soviet Union in this regard is the lack of ideological commitment. That is to say, the discussions on the ideological arena domestically are very much toward questioning the utility of any foreign aid when we have so many problems at home. Questioning the utility of specific allies like Nicaragua and Cuba to the purposes of the Soviet Union. Now, these are private academics, but they're private academics who hold very prominent responsible positions and whose views get aired in the press. And obviously, partly to influence our thinking, but I think, frankly, more to influence the thinking of people in the Soviet Union. So, in addition to that, there seems to simply be an additional effort, which many people have surmised, with regard to Eastern Europe, that is to say that Gorbachev was more than just sitting back and watching events unfold in Eastern Europe, that he might have played some role in encouraging this process at key points, allowing, so to speak, the good guys to win by action or inaction. We do see indications of that in other countries as well, that is to say the entire Soviet the tenor of the dialogue that they have with local governments, which are their clients, and with local communist parties, reflects a differing relationship and a differing set of expectations between the Soviet Union and those client states. So I think that that's very encouraging, which is not to say, obviously, if a regime has either a popular backing or a very solid grip on the instruments of control in those areas, the Soviet Union is not going to go in and liberate them any more than the United States is, so there's no predictive value to saying Cuba will fall or something like that in any particular time frame. Although, again, looking at Eastern Europe, one might surmise that our lack of foresight there might be matched by lack of foresight in other areas. I don't know.
One final question, Howard Cromwell.
Is there not a correlation between the level of education in dictatorial countries and what we're seeing now? Have the Russians not sown the seeds of this by elevating the education of its masses? And does not communism work best when the peasantry is dumb?
Well, I believe that anyone who is exposed to a greater variety of ideas is going to compare ideas. I'm not sure the peasants were ever that dumb. After all, they fought collectivization and paid with their lives. Some estimates go as high as 20 million deaths. You remember Stalin's famous remark to Churchill when Churchill casually confided in him that wasn't terrible how many Russians had been lost, or Soviet citizens had been lost in the struggle against the Germans, he said, and Stalin said, ah, you think that was a war? A real war was fighting the peasants in our country. That was a real war. Give you some indication of the bloodshed involved. So in terms of certainly having a vision for the country, and many of the country's leaders are always going to tend to be more educated, I suppose what I would find to be a better guarantee of democracy, of the prospects for democracy in any nation, or the degree to which those intellectually inspired leaders actually listen to the people on the bottom, who may not sort of be able to formulate their ideas as well, but know what they want. You know, they know that they want to be able to till their own land and sell their own goods and not have any of these problems that are constantly interposed and imposed upon them by the bureaucracy. And if you want to see an example of democracy in action in the Soviet Union, instinctively from, so to speak, the lowest intellectual social class, look at 2 million miners that coordinated their activities last July, basically shut the country down, and came out in short order with political demands. The first political demands, to abolish Article 6 of the Constitution, that is to say the article that enshrines the guiding role of the Communist Party, and later sections of that movement made even more specific political demands for the removal of the Politburo and others. But they didn't have any intellectual inspiration. As a matter of fact, they rather frowned on intellectuals telling them what to do, because they knew.
When Nick Petro was at the Miller Center, he distinguished himself by wanting to get inside the Carter and the Reagan administration to see how they administered their human rights policy. And he wrote a little book called The Predicament of Human Rights, The Carter and Reagan Policies. Now he's inside the State Department, although still an academic and an egghead, maybe. That kind of blending of the two is certainly one thing we would hope the Miller Center for many, many years to come could encourage young people to consider. You've more than whatever other groups have lived up to expectations, you've more than lived up to our expectations. We thank you very much.
Thank you.